This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Omar Elukim Ken Yenochem on Birois HaMilchomo, for Hashem said, lest the people will have second thoughts when they see war. V'shovu Mitzrayim, they might return to Mitzrayim. Says Rashi, what does it mean? God didn't take them through the land of Plishtim because it's near. It's a funny sort of statement. If I tell you, if you want to know how to get from here to somewhere else, and I say, well, don't go down that road, that's the shortcut. Go down the long road. Doesn't make any sense, says Rashi. Ki koroivu, it's the short way, v'noach loshuv ba'isoy haderech l'mitzrayim. And it is therefore comfortable to return along the same route back to Mitzrayim. So God fooled the people. He made them think it was a long way to go. They were very stupid people. They had no clue of where Israel was, where Israel was, and where Mitzrayim was. They didn't know that in all the backwards and forwards of Yosef's brothers several times, and of Yaakov coming down, that it was a 10-day walk from Eretz Israel to Mitzrayim. They had no clue anything about it, and God pulled the wool over their eyes, schlepped them up and down along the desert, and they thought it was a long way, so when they want to go back, they wouldn't know how to get back. What kind of business is this? Yaakov found his way to Mitzrayim. The brothers found their way to Mitzrayim. Traders were going backwards and forwards all the time between Mitzrayim and Canaan. Backwards and forwards, the route was clear. Everybody knew. What does the Ribbono Shel Olam expect to achieve by, so to say, leading them some long route in an attempt to make it more difficult for them to return? The Rambam gives two reasons. He says in the Moreh Nevuchim, the third Chelek Perek Lamed Beis, he's talking about a different subject altogether, but this merely he brings in around. And by the way, K'mo shehoyo michochmas Hashem, just as it was part of God's wisdom, leheisev oisom bamidbar, to dray them around in the desert, ad sheyilmudu gvuro, until they had sufficient time to develop strength. K'mo shenoido, as it is well known, shehahalicho bamidba, the traveling in the desert, umiut hanos haguf, and a diminishment of physical pleasure, meirchitzo chayotze bohem, such as washing, and so on, yoilidu hagvuro, those inconveniences and discomfort give rise to strength. And the opposite, having comfort and ease, leads to softness. And so, says the Rambam, the Ribbono Shel Olam had to lead them through a sufficient period of discomfort in order that they should develop the strength to be able to fight the wars that lay ahead of them. And secondly, says the Rambam, V'noldu gamken anoshim shelo hirgilu b'shiflus v'avdus. And then a generation was also born who were not accustomed to humility and slavery. It's another sheet of the Rambam. The part of the reason was that there should be a nation not schooled in slavery, but open to independence and freedom. We want to deal with the first reason given by the Rambam, which is extremely strange. The Rambam says they had to go through the desert because only through the discomfort of traveling in the desert would they develop the strength needed to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And what about the discomfort of living in Mitzrayim? Why was that not good enough? The torture, the slavery, the humiliation, the toil and the hard work, wasn't that sufficient to toughen them up? Couldn't they go straight from Egypt to Eretz Israel? What could living in the desert add to their hardship and to their discomfort. Could desert life have been any worse than life in Mitzrayim? True, now and again they get a bit upset and they say they want to go back to Mitzrayim. Okay? The grass is always greener on the other side. It just shows how true that is. That when we encounter a bit of discomfort, the tendency to run away is so great that even if the only place you can run to is Mitzrayim, you'll still run to Mitzrayim. Like one finds in South Africa today, Jews running to all sorts of funny places, which aren't exactly the places that they're going to be more better off, some of them, in any way than they are over here. But when you believe, when you're going through difficulties and you think running away is your option, even to Mitzrayim you're prepared to run. But those were only at times of crisis. Normally, surely, their existence in the desert was more comfortable than their existence in Mitzrayim. And particularly since they had the miracles in the desert. Can you imagine a life like that? They didn't have to work. They didn't have to do. There was nothing they had to do. There were the Anone Kovid protecting them. There was Mon and Slav. There was the Be'er that followed them around and gave them water. And all they had to do was sit and learn Torah. What more idyllic situation is there than that? And Hoses the Rambam, they had to be toughened up in the desert without the ability to wash and to have a hard time because they have to be prepared for the gevurah, the strength that they're going to need to conquer the land, which they didn't have when they came out of Mitzrayim. And the Rambam says a similar thing earlier on in Perek Kav Dalet. Also, by the way, Ki hamenucha tasir hagevurah, he says. For leisure removes strength of character. That's fine. V'tzuka parnosa v'ha'omol yitnu hagevurah. And the pressure of parnosa, of earning a living, and of omal, and the toil of it, adds to one's strength of character. Good, that's also fine. And that's the goodness which came to them from having to spend so much time in the desert. They developed that gevura. What is the Rambam saying? They needed the desert because before that they had menucha. That menucha weakens character and toil for earning a living strengthens character. Where did they have to work harder for their living? In Mitzrayim or in the desert? So what does the Rambam mean? That they had to leave Mitzrayim and spend time in the desert in order to experience the hardship of toil, as if they were on holiday for 200 years in Mitzrayim. And this difficulty is strengthened by a view of Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel answers the same question as to why they had to, what really was God's intention in taking them so on such a long, circuitous route. V'hikadei laharbois lohem oisus umoifsi. That was in order to increase the number of miracles that God could do for them. Ki'ilu oilichom derech eretz plishtim akoruv. For if God had taken them through eretz plishtim, they wouldn't have been war and fighting and so on, then they wouldn't have had the opportunity of experiencing as many miracles as they did going the long way around. So Rabbeinu Chananel says that the reason is, the main reason was in fact the miracles. And the miracles made their lives easy. So what really is going on here? What does the Rambam mean to say when he tells us that the reason that God wanted them to spend so long there was not to fool them that it's a long way around, but to give them enough strength so that when they encountered the wars of Canaan, they wouldn't want to run away. They would be able to face the difficulty, they would be able to face the hardship and conquer it and be victorious. In other words, the Rambam says that the period in the desert was educational. It was necessary for them to endure that period in the desert in order to develop strength of character. That was a period of learning and of studying and of growth. How was that achieved, says the Rambam? Not by the Torah they learned. Not by sitting in the kollel. That's not what got them strong. What got them strong was the tzuka parnosa v'ha'oma, the pressure of earning a living and the hard work. Where in the desert was their hard work? Where in the desert was their pressure of earning a living? And here we have to analyze, what is it, in fact, that they didn't have in Mitzrayim, that they did have in the desert? Why was their Egyptian existence not able to train them for what they needed later on. Why did they need it? What does the Rambam mean? The one reason the Rambam gives is fine, we have no difficulty with that. That in Mitzrayim they were taught, they were trained in slavery and humility, and that would make it difficult for them to fight against kings. Good. They needed time to grow out of that. But the second reason that the Rambam gives, that they needed hard work, they needed toil and labor, as if that's what they were lacking, that's very difficult to understand. We have to say that the Rambam is not referring to physical labor. When the Rambam says Suk haparnoso v'ha'omal, those are the words that he uses, and although this is a translation, after all it's a translation of a Rishon. And when the Rambam says Suk haparnoso, the pressure of parnoso and the omal and the hard work, the difficulty of earning a living is not the physical labor. As far as physical labor is concerned, the woman who stays at home and doesn't go out to earn a living works harder than the man. A man goes to his office and sits behind the desk and shuffles paper around the whole day. And a woman has to go shopping and carry the groceries and schlep the children. As far as toil is concerned, there's far more toil in the day-to-day affairs of just running a home than there is in the earning a living. And even those who earn their living by physical labor, I don't think that there are many jobs which are, from the point of view of toil, more demanding than the job of running a home. You're a bricklayer, dig trenches, whatever you do, there's very little that one can imagine which demands more physical stamina than that which is demanded from a woman who's running a home with children, people in and out all the time. That's about the most demanding physically job that there is. So what does the Rambam mean when he says the omal, the tsukha parnoso and the omal, the pressure of parnoso and the omal, the torture of earning a living is the uncertainty of it. The torture of earning a living is the insecurity of it. And that's why many people choose to become civil servants. In fact, in this country there are very few people who choose not to become civil servants, because although the civil service doesn't offer high wages, and although the civil service doesn't offer an exciting career usually, it offers security for the rest of their lives, and usually afterwards as well, they know they're provided for, safe and sound. Whereas when a person opens his own business and risks a bit of capital, does he know how it's going to work out? Does he know it's going to be successful? And even when a person takes a job, will he be able to keep it up? There's competition, there are other people after the same job, his needs are going to increase, will he be able to increase his income in accordance with his needs? Is there long-term job security? What about inflation? All these things create what the Rambam calls sukh ha-parnosa, the pressure of parnosa. The pressure of parnosa is not the work of today. The pressure of parnoso is the worry of tomorrow. People who have heart attacks through their work don't have heart attacks because they're working hard. They have heart attacks because they're worried. That's why they have heart attacks. They're worried not about today. Today, Baruch Hashem, they're fine. You'll see a man who has a cardiograph and it's going all funny, and you'll say, well, what are you worried about? Everything's fine. You've got a home, you've got a wife, you've got children. He'll tell you he's worried about something tomorrow. There's a deal which is coming off, and he's going to lose a lot of money, and what will happen to his home, and what will happen to his family. It's always tomorrow which causes the tsuk, which causes the enormous pressure, which leads one to overwork today to try and secure tomorrow. If somehow we each knew that we don't have to worry about tomorrow, if each one of us knew that from Tuesday our panosa is guaranteed, all we have to worry about is Monday, we would be fairly relaxed. We would go about our work as well as we could. We would take any old job we could get. We would clean the streets, whatever it is, for one day to make sure we have panosa for Monday, that we can come home in the evening and we can buy some food to support the family. And we would go to bed that night very relaxed and comfortable. Tomorrow's fixed up. It's only because tomorrow isn't fixed up that we're uncomfortable today. And not only uncomfortable, that is the reason why we work like mad, we work like crazy, and we plan and we scheme and we plot and we accumulate today. Because who knows what will be tomorrow? That's the tsuka parnosa and the yoma. What about Mitzrayim? In Mitzrayim they had to work. But you remember Chazal say what avodas porech is, that men had to work like women. That means all men had to do was to schlep and to toil. Doesn't necessarily mean that men were put to cook and to look after the children. The Mitzrayim weren't crazy. They needed laborers. They weren't going to take their strong men and make them do the knitting and the sewing, and take weak women and make them carry the bricks. That's not the pshat in avodas porech. The pshat in avodas porech is men carried the bricks and mixed the mortar and built the buildings. But that's the work for a woman. Because what a man has to do is use his judgment. What a man has to do is take risks and plan for tomorrow. And that the Mitzrayim didn't allow him to do. We'll feed you tomorrow. Don't worry. Your parnosa is guaranteed. All you have to do is slave and toil. A woman is protected from the tsuka parnosa. A good husband doesn't allow his wife to know what's going through his mind, what he's worried about. When he lies awake at night worrying how he's going to pay the accounts at the end of the month and what he's going to tell the bank manager tomorrow when he's been called to a meeting, and he tosses and turns in bed and he can't sleep, and his wife wakes up and says, "What's the matter?" He says, "I don't know, bit of insomnia, nothing serious." And she goes back to sleep, and he carries on tossing and turning. That's a good husband. The foolish husband says, "Oh, what do you mean, well, I can't sleep? Do you think you would be able to sleep if you had to meet the bank manager tomorrow?" And then the two of them can't sleep. A woman's work is hard, demanding, toil, laborious. It's an incredible mesirus nefesh that she has to go through in order to make the home work. But one thing she needs: security. She is entitled to feel this almost euphoric insulation from the real trouble of the world. And that's why we don't like our women going out to work. Strictly speaking, al pi Torah, a woman should work, yes, but she should take work into the home. We like to protect our women from the insecurities of the commercial world outside. She's entitled to that protection. When Paroi worked the men like women, he worked them in toil and in labor. And he said to them, "Don't worry about tomorrow. Everything's all right for tomorrow. You don't have to worry where your next meal's coming from. We'll give it to you." The first communistic system. We'll take care. You just give us your labor. We'll take care of your life. And on the surface, that should be the most wonderful thing. I don't have to worry about tomorrow. You mean I don't have to worry? Not only about tomorrow, says Paroi, you don't even have to worry about your retirement. We'll take care of that. We've got pension schemes. Everything's worked out. All I want from you is to do your work. That's all. I promise you, you'll have all the food that you need. You'll have what you need. Normally, the tsuka parnosa and the oma, the pressure of work and the toil, is usually referred to in Torah circles as a negative element. It's a great chiddush in the Rambam to find this referred to as the necessary training to go through that stage to be able to graduate from slavery to chayrus. To be able to graduate from Eretz Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael. That they had to go through the educational procedure, the educational process of tsuka parnosa and the yoma. that which we regard as so negative, as the source of heart attacks and ulcers, that which we regard as what distracts us from our learning Torah and from our practicing of mitzvahs, and we sometimes crave a semi-socialist sort of setup. We imagine how wonderful it would be if it was all laid on. That's Mitzrayim that we're craving. When we seek security, when we want to become civil servants, when we want to eliminate risk and to eliminate the decision-taking process, what we're craving is Mitzrayim, exactly as they did. And we learn the Chumash, we don't understand. What do you mean they want to go back to Mitzrayim? Didn't they have enough there? It's very enticing, a Mitzrayim kind of existence. No matter how hard I have to work, not to have to worry about Parnosa. Do you know what a blessing that sounds, that seems to be on the surface? Not have to worry where my accounts are going to be paid from? Not have to worry how I'm going to marry off my children? Kibbutzim have offered that kind of existence, and people in the past have jumped at it. Communists and socialists have offered that kind of existence, and some people have jumped at it. But that's a nisna rosh v'noshuvu Mitzrayim. That's a desire to return to Mitzrayim. I'm prepared to give you my labor. Just remove from me the threat of insecurity, the worry about tomorrow. That threat and that worry, which the Rambam says makes a person a man, that threat which turns a slave into a free man, that threat which makes a person confident and gives him stature, that's what we crave to relieve ourselves of. Aren't we out of our minds? Rabbeinu Chananel, we said, mentions that the reason that God wanted them to be so long in the desert was to do miracles. And we ask, but miracles is simply a continuation of the Mitzrayim situation. Don't worry, miracles. Mon will come every morning, you don't have to worry. And in a sense it would appear that Rabbeinu Chananel's answer therefore is in total contrast to the Rambam's. In what way does a miraculous existence contribute to the development of that gevura which the Rambam requires or expects that they were supposed to develop during their period in the Midbar? But it can't be in contrast to the Rambam, because the Rambam also knew they lived a miraculous life. So whether that was the reason for their long stay in the Midbar or not, how can the Rambam say that the purpose of being in the desert was to develop gevura when their existence in the desert was miraculous? And that we can answer with the most amazing little piece of Rabbeinu Bechaye. Rabbeinu Bechaye links the word Nes with the word Nisoyon. Nes, miracle. Nisoyon means trial, tribulation. And it's the same root, Nun Samach. And in fact, when we're introduced to the Mon in our Sedra, the word, that is exactly how it's expressed, in fact. Where the Ribbono Shel Olam says, I'm going to bring you Mon, Lama'an Anasenu Hayelech B'Seirosi Yimlod. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm going to bring them the Nes of Mon, Lama'an Anasenu. We see that word being used again in its double meaning. In order to test them, in order to try them. So there seems to be already a little linkage, that the miracles are there, as the Rambam said, to strengthen them, to test them, to try them. Rabbeinu Bechaye says that b'feirush, Sheroiv hanisim asher nase lohem bamidbar. The majority of the miracles which were done to them in the desert, hoyu kedei livchoin et libom, were made in order to test their hearts, ulahavion lidei nisoyin, and to bring them to trial. Ke'inyan Kriyas Yamsuf. For example, Kriyas Yamsuf, says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, and he describes Kriyas Yamsuf in the most unusual way. He says, Sheloi nikro hayam lohem beyachad la'asos lohem b'seichu shvil oroch mitchilos ve'ad sofa. Don't picture the splitting of the Red Sea in the way that they came there, walked into the water, and then all of a sudden it split all the way across. No, says Rabbeinu Bechaya. Elo ma'at ma'at, it was little by little. Ki hayam ayon nas mipneihem, because as the Medrash says, the water actually ran away from them. Umidei Ovram, and when they stood there in the water, Hayuroyim Hayom Leinayim, in front of them was the sea. So do you see the picture as Rabbeinu Bechaya explains it? When they walked into the sea, they had a wall of water on their left, and they had a wall of water on their right, and they had a wall of water in front of them. Can you imagine anything more terrifying? Where do you go? A massive wall of water, a sheet of water in front of them. How do you walk? Where do you go? The miracles didn't solve their problems. The miracles aggravated their problems. It's all very well. You come up against the sea with the Mitzrayim behind you, the Egyptians are behind you, the sea is in front of you. I have a problem. Start walking into the sea. The sea splits. Problem solved? No, problem not solved. What does it help? The sea splits for 2 yards, and then I've still got the sea in front of me. Take another step forward. The sea moves back a step. But do I know that it's going to continue that way until I get to the other end? No. That's the uncertainty of tomorrow. The Ribbono Shel Olam did not, through miracles, remove from them the uncertainty of tomorrow. Only Paroi removed from them the uncertainty of tomorrow. And to remove the uncertainty of tomorrow from a human being is to destroy his humanity. It's to destroy his potency and to destroy his stature. To make a human being secure in the knowledge that his future is cared for makes of him an invalid. It's only when the human being doesn't know where tomorrow is going to lead him that he has to think, that he has to work, that he has the tsukha parnoso and the oma. Of course we know that the mon worked exactly the same way as Rabbeinu Bechaya said. Only enough for one day. Each day they went, and they were only permitted to collect enough mon for one day. And we've often described the kind of feeling that they must have had, a feeling unknown, Baruch Hashem, to most of us. A feeling of having in your house only enough for today, to go into the pantry, the fridge, the freezer, and there's only enough for today, nothing to feed the children tomorrow, not any milk for tomorrow, no eggs for tomorrow, no fish, no meat, no fruit, no vegetables, nothing for tomorrow, and no job. What was that to live like that? For 40 years to live like that. Today a miracle happened. Somebody walked in and delivered a food basket. Never seen him before. And in it was everything that we needed. But just enough. What's going to happen tomorrow? Funny thing happens tomorrow again. Another stranger walks in, delivers a food basket. But this continuous miracle doesn't make me feel any more comfortable about tomorrow. On the contrary, one keeps on feeling, when is the luck going to run out? How long can this go on for? Who is this bringing me the food? Why are they bringing me the food? What do I need to do to keep it going this way? What happens if it stops? It's a feeling that is almost impossible for us to imagine. Because even if we could imagine such a state, we still think to ourselves, you know, there's a Chevra Kedisha to help out. Their friends to help out. One can borrow a bit of money. One can tide oneself over. But in the Midbar, the Chevra Kedisha had nothing either. The bank was empty. there was nothing on the supermarket shelves either. There was nothing available for hundreds of miles. There was no chance of food. And each day, all they had was just for the one day. That's the same as the Rabbeinu Bechaya described their passage through the Yam Suf. Step by step. All I know is that where I'm standing now is dry. Where my next step is going to be, there's no sign of anything dry. There's just a sign of who knows what depth of water. How am I going to get in there? How am I going to take that next step? Who knows? Now I'm dry, that's all I can know. If I'm walking down the road, walking down 10th Avenue, and I know I have to get from here to the end, to Dharma Road, I don't need to be a great intellect to figure out how to do it. You start walking, and you keep on walking, and you get to the end. Simple. I can use that time to prepare a Gemara Shir. Don't have to use any thought on how to get there. But if I stand at the bottom of an enormous mountain, and I know where I want to get, I want to get to the top, but there are no paths, no signposts, no route map, nothing. And I stand down at the bottom and I look up at the top, and all I see is rocks, cliffs, enormous rock barriers, valleys, rivers. And I've got to figure out how to get from here to there. That needs thinking. I've got to take certain decisions. I've got to plan. And I've got to be adaptable. I can plan my walk and I can start off. And very soon I realize this isn't going to work. I have to change my plan. I have to suffer the consequences of my mistakes and enjoy the fruits of my correct decisions. When I've decided a particular route and all of a sudden I see, oh, look how beautifully it's working, it's going just where I wanted to get. And look at the beautiful scenery on the way that I'm passing. I can enjoy that. I chose correctly. And then when I choose my next path and I find that I'm right, of course, I've got to walk all the way back and schlep all my things with me. I've got to suffer the consequences of my decisions. That's life. That's living with seichel. That's living with a forced situation where I have to think, where if I don't think, I can't survive. In Mitzrayim, they did not have to worry about where they were going. The road was clear. All you have to do is produce X number of bricks. That's what you have to do. Everything else I take care of, says Paro. On the surface, a wonderful offer. In truth, the destruction of the human spirit. Because that creates a working situation which denies the human being the need to think. And we're funny things, human beings, we're lazy. If we don't need to think, we usually stop thinking. We only think when we have to. But yet thinking is what differentiates us from the animal. And to take for ourselves a course of life which doesn't demand thinking is choosing for ourselves the course of life suitable for an animal. It's an evet. You don't have to think. When Bnei Yisrael stand in the sea, where they're standing is dry. There are Mitzrim behind them, and in front of them is a sheet of water. What do you have to do at that point? And they started davening, and remember what the Ribbono Shel Olam said. No time to daven. Go. Get moving. Get moving. Where? What do you have to do? You have to think. What can I do now which is going to make the next step possible? That's what I need to do. And how did they think that through? So you've got to make certain assumptions and certain logical conclusions. By all the laws of physics, I cannot take another step forward. That means the only way I can take a step forward is by God's intervention. For God's intervention, I need God's rachamim and his chesed. To have God's rachamim and chesed, I need to be doing Torah and mitzvahs. I need to serve him. What can I do at this moment which the Ribbono Shel Olam would want me to do? Is it time to say Kriya Shema? Is it time to put on tefillin? Is it time to give tzedakah? Is it time to learn a blat Gemara? What am I supposed to be doing now that will give the Ribbono Shel Olam sufficient satisfaction to be willing to help me out? You need to think it through. It's not a question of what will I do tomorrow. It's simply a question of what should I be doing now? What is it right for me to do now? Don't worry about tomorrow. There's nothing I can do about tomorrow. It's completely and totally beyond me. All I can do is use everything I've got in my mind to analyze what I'm meant to be doing now. And then I've got to leave tomorrow alone. The Ribbono Shel Olam sorts that out. And each Jew worked it out for himself. One Jew was saying his Kriya Shema, and one was chazering his Shir, and one was saying Tehillim. Each one did what he felt the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted of him. One was doing a chesed, one was helping an old person or a child. And that enabled the Ribbono Shel Olam to take them through the next step. Good. The sea moves another meter beyond. Now what are you going to do? Comes the same question again. And so it was with Amon. What can I do about earning a living tomorrow? The Bnei Israel could ask themselves. Nothing. There's nothing you can do about tomorrow. You've got nothing for tomorrow, nor is anything available for tomorrow. So what? All you can ensure is that you live like a mensch today. If you make it worthwhile for the Ribbono Shel Olam to preserve you, he'll find something for you tomorrow, the same as he found for you today. So enrich the quality of your life today, and tomorrow will be alright. But how do you enrich the quality of your life today? That needs seichel. To figure out what the Ribbono Shel Olam really wants of me. To think out what I'm meant to be doing, what my mission is today. That needs thought. That needs depth. That needs analysis. And so when the human being finds that his tomorrow is blocked, he's forced to think. When his way is clear, there's no need to think at all. And we think it's the other way around. We think that if my way is clear, what a blessing that is. Ah, how one envies those people whose way is clear, they know exactly where they're going. And how tragic it is for poor me, we think. Well, I'm not quite sure where I'm going tomorrow. I know where I would like to go. I know where I would like to be. But how do I get there? And I look enviously at the person who's walking down the M1 when I stand at the bottom of a large peak in the Drakensberg trying to figure out where I'm supposed to go and what I'm supposed to do. All I know is I'm supposed to get up there. But he, the lucky fellow, he just sits on the highway and he goes. For a cow, he's taka a lucky fellow. But for a human being, it's not lucky to be on a highway. A human being needs the pressure of having to take decisions in order to grow, in order to develop gevura, in order to develop strength. I've given you the example before. Imagine you come along and we say, look, let's play roulette. Nothing to do, it's Saturday night, let's play roulette, fine. We sit down to play, and we decide, you know, who wants to lose a lot of money? Nobody feels like losing money. We'll play with plastic chips, no monetary value. After 5 minutes, the game's a bore. There's no fun in it anymore. If you put monetary value, then the game becomes serious and becomes interesting. Why? It's decisions, it's real. I've got to suffer the consequences of my mistakes and enjoy the fruits of my correct moves. That's a certain enjoyment. There's a certain nachas. And how much more that works in real life. A person has a bit of money, he's got to decide where to invest it. And he thinks, wouldn't it be nice if somebody was taking care of this for me? If you're a cow, it would be nice for somebody to take care of these things and give the hay to you every morning for you to eat. But you're not a cow. You're a human being. And you take your money and you open your business day and you look at all the possible investments, hundreds of them, and you've got to start thinking. And you've got to start analyzing. And some people tell you A and some people tell you B. But you're not a cow. You don't do what they tell you. You want to do what you think yourself. And you decide. And you invest your money in a particular avenue. It turns out to have been a hopeless flop. You lose half of it. That's life. And then you shake the dust off, and you sit down and you say to yourself, 1 minute. To make a mistake, that anybody can do. One thing though, I'm not a cow. I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. What went wrong last time? And you sit and you figure out, why was I mistaken? Not enough research. A wrong assumption. I didn't think of one of the factors. And so you grow. And you say, right, I've only got half left. Where am I going to put it now? And again, you spend weeks analyzing and figuring out, and you invest it. And Baruch Hashem, this time it grows, doubles, it triples. You have the nachas. You've done right, it's been correct. A feeling of stature, a feeling of success. That's the human being. We grow from our mistakes and we grow from our success, provided they're ours. Anybody can grow from his mistakes. Nobody can grow from somebody else's mistake. If you made a bad investment, I get no growth out of it. If I made a bad investment, I get growth out of it. If you took the wrong turning on the Drakensberg, I get no benefit. If I took the wrong turning, I get benefit. At least I know. Where did I go wrong? What was wrong? Why did I misjudge? And my experience is gained. I grow, I develop, I become more competent. Likewise, if you make the right decision and you make a lot of money on the stock exchange, I get no benefit. If I make the right decision, even if I only make a little bit of money on the stock exchange, I do get the benefit. Rather let it be your own and very little than be somebody else's and a very lot. What can you gain out of somebody else's fortune? And how much you can gain out of your own meager little pennies? It works like that in everything. If somebody else has used his seichel and has understood a piece of Gemara or a Tosfos or whatever, not much I can get out of his pleasure. But if I've used my intellect, even if it's only an infinitesimal part of his, he's an ilui. He's a genius and I'm just an ordinary person. But it doesn't help me that he's understanding. I want to understand as best I can. And even if I can progress 1 millimeter, that millimeter is mine. And I can enjoy it. And I can have nachas from it, and I can grow from it. Whereas the genius's kilometer that he's managed to achieve, that does nothing for me. That doesn't help me one little bit. So tragic is it that we live today so much like the Yidden lived in Mitzrayim, rather than as they had to live in the Midbar and later on in Eretz Yisrael. Our craving for security is so great that we're prepared to sacrifice our humanity for security. We're prepared to do what other people tell us to do without thinking. We're prepared to follow what other people are doing without thinking. And even in our learning, we start misunderstanding and confusing quotation with understanding. And if I ask you something and you can quote me the answer, I think you're a genius. I say, you know, interesting shayla I have, and I tell you the shayla. You say, oh, that's no problem. So and so and so and so and such a page asks the same shayla, and he says, this is the answer. I say, my goodness. What a genius. And I go and do it. I'm an Egyptian. Or rather, I'm a slave to an Egyptian. I didn't understand it. You don't understand it. And yet I admire. What am I admiring? That you're a computer? That you've absorbed a piece of information? What's it got to do with me? Much better that I should work it out myself and toil and struggle and battle and sweat and labor and make a mistake rather, but do it myself. From that I can grow. And the Ribbono Shel Olam will not have tainas against us for making mistakes if we did our best. He will have tainas against us even for doing right. If it wasn't our own. I gave the ladies an example this morning in the Tanakh that we were learning. We've just gone through a string of the most wicked kings imaginable, one after the other. Idolaters, murderers, wicked kings from Yerovam all the way down to Achav. And in the end, Achav gets the wrath of the Ribbono Shel Olam more than any of the others. Although, in a sense, Achav has something to him. You find that there's some depth to Achav. He's not quite as much of a Rosha in some ways than some of the others, and yet, he gets by far the greatest punishment. And the Tanakh says, Rak loy hoyo ke Achav. There was nobody as wicked as Achav. Why? What was so terribly wicked? Says the Tanakh, Asher hismakel lasois hora b'einei Hashem. He sold himself to do evil in God's eyes, but so did they all.
Adds the Tanakh. Asher heisato oisoi izevel ishtoi.
He didn't do it of his own choice. He allowed his wife Izevel to seduce him into doing it. For that he's punished. Doing evil yourself? Good. That's something you have to sort out with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and why you did it. But to allow someone else to talk you into doing evil, that's inexcusable.
Achov is punished not so much for the evil he did, for he didn't do that much more evil than the other kings. He's punished because it wasn't his own.
Just as we are credited, the Ribbono Shel Olam rewards us when something good we do is our own, also he punishes us when the wicked we do isn't our own. We've just quoted it, we've adapted it from somewhere else. We've taken it on. This tendency not to have to think, this tendency to view everything being put upon us on a golden tray as the ideal, to desire everything to be presented to one in a neatly packaged form already, is all part of the Mitzrayim complex. The communism of the world, the socialism of all that is part of the Mitzrayim complex. And so the Ribbono Shel Olam leads Am Yisrael around the long way, not to confuse them, not to make them think that there's a long distance between Mitzrayim and Canaan, they know exactly what it is, but to enable them to endure the hardships of miracles as preparation for their life in Eretz Yisrael. And that phrase we spoke earlier about the need to have a title for every presentation. The title for this shiur would be The Hardship of Miracles. This title that before the shiur we wouldn't understand what it means. Hardship of miracles? What kind of hardship? The hardship of a miracle is, as Rabbeinu Bechaya explains, a miracle. Because a miracle doesn't sort out tomorrow's problem. A miracle aggravates tomorrow's problem by sorting today out. It makes the contrast all the greater. To have plenty to eat today and nothing to eat tomorrow. Don't forget the mon wasn't just, they didn't have just enough. They had plenty for today. But they couldn't save up one little bit of it, not one crumb of it for tomorrow. The miracles aggravated. When they stood in the dry land in the sea, it wasn't muddy. It was absolutely dry. And yet the next step was totally wet and full of water. The contrast was so great that their ability to handle tomorrow was tested to the absolute. That's the hardship of living by miracles. And they had to endure the hardship of living by miracles in order to learn once again how to think, how to work out what to do now in order to ensure that I can get to the top of the mountain. It's no good looking at the top of the mountain. I've got to decide down here, where do I go? Do I turn left? Do I turn right? Do I go straight? No paths. These are decisions I have to make. And when I look back at the progress I've made, it's my progress. I chose it. I made the progress. I've done it myself. And I look up at the next peak and I see a professional mountain climber. Oh, he's just going up, no problems, far ahead of me. Doesn't make any difference. There's nothing that he can give me. I cannot benefit from his climb. If he falls, I will not be hurt. And if he gets to the top, I will not benefit. And so there's no place for jealousy. And there's no place for comparison. All I'm interested in is the effectiveness of my own decisions. Am I working correctly? Am I making the right decisions? Am I progressing? And if not, where am I going wrong? What am I doing wrong? Let me adapt. Let me identify the mistake and adapt quickly and correct it. And that too is a great thrill, to be able to look back and say, I was heading for disaster. And I was able to identify the disaster and alter my course. And I saved myself. Even that is a wonderful feeling. If one is an employee and one's boss comes to one afterwards and says, you know, just save the company from disaster, you've got a job still, you're okay. That doesn't give any nachas. But to the balabos it gives nachas.
I worked it out. I did it. I saved us. That adds stature. That's the obligation of every human being. How far we get is not in our hands. Whether we make it to our destinations or not is not in our hands. What our destinations are, we have to choose. Where the final destination is, that we have to decide. And then we have to start thinking. And not for a moment in our lives are we permitted to stop thinking. Because if we carry on for one moment not thinking, we're living lives of animals. Constantly analyzing, constantly thinking, constantly risking. Because thinking is a risk. One might follow the wrong tack. Sometimes you're preparing a piece of Gemara and you've thought something out and you try it. And you can spend a good few hours before you hit a stone wall. And you realize it's all been a waste of time. But it hasn't been a waste of time. Because you thought wrong, you discovered your mistake, you backtracked, and you will never make that mistake again. It's not all for nothing. Whereas if you at the beginning say, look, I don't want to spend all this time working it out, tell me, call somebody over, how do you learn this piece of Gemara? Oh, this is easy, this is how you learn it. Thank you, you say, on to the next page. Is that learning? Is that thinking? Is that being a human being? And at the end of it, I've learned 100 pages. I haven't learned 100 pages. My teacher learned 100 pages. I just heard them. And I happen to have a good enough memory to remember what he told me. Is that called thinking? Is that called humanity? Is that called exploiting myself and taking myself to my ultimate reaches? That's nothing. That's an animal's existence. Come along and say, I made a lot of money on the stock exchange. Say, so how did you do it? Huh? Somebody told me to put the money on such and such a share. It's true you've got the money, but you haven't got the growth. You've got the money, but the money hasn't affected you. You can't take credit for your decision. You've learned nothing from it. You've had no thrill, nothing. It's all your friend who did it. And it's so in everything we do. You can chap another blot of Gomorrah, but it won't change you. You can make another 1,000 rand, but it won't change you. But every step you take through your own decision, every mistake you make and every bit of progress you make, it might not be 1,000 rand, it might be 1 rand. It might not be 100 blot, it might be 1 blot, but it's yours. That guarantees progress. That guarantees that the human being is thinking and is developing. And through that thinking and through that developing, it guarantees not necessarily that he will reach his destination, but that he will get as far as the Ribbono Shel Olam expects him to get.